Hello, everyone. This is John Brassard, Jr., the Kitchen Table Historian. Welcome back to the table. This week, I'm doing something a little different, so I hope that you enjoy it. After you're done listening, please be sure to let me know what you think on any of my social media outlets, the Kitchen Table Historian on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or in the comments section of my website, www.johnbrassardjr.com. As always, I ask that you would please like, subscribe, recommend, write a review, or tell a friend or five about the podcast. This helps more people to find their way to the table and allows these great pieces of history to spread even further. When I was younger, I spent a year working for a big box retail chain. One day, I noticed that one of my fellow employees, we'll call her Mary, wasn't feeling well. She was elderly, and I went over to see how she was doing. I ended up sitting with her for an hour or two, a little afraid to leave her alone at the time. Management had been contacted, but they hadn't shown up yet. I thought that she might have had a heart attack or a stroke or something, and I wanted to make sure that she had someone with her if she did. Mary was very appreciative, and as the time passed, she began to talk a little about herself. One subject ran into another, and before long she was telling me about her experiences during World War II. Mary said that she had been one member of a vast number of women that had gone to work during that time to help support the war effort. She worked on an assembly line in a munitions factory, making bullets. Even decades later, Mary still remembered the order that the specialized rounds were manufactured in. It was a glimpse into an aspect of that time that I didn't know much about. Sure, I'd read about military strategy, battle accounts, and even Rosie the Riveter doing her part on the home front. But reading books and watching documentaries are different. Mary had actually lived it. In researching larger stories, I frequently come across smaller stories that are no less interesting. The problem is that there just isn't much to them. They're like snapshots into someone's life, like the time Mary spent on the assembly line during the war. Frequently, there isn't much insight into the people in the stories. They don't have any backstory, and they are never mentioned anywhere else again. They're more like characters in a TV show. They're a side character in one episode, and then they disappear again. But how many people are like that in our own lives? How many people do we walk past in the grocery store or see in the movie theater? They all have stories, but you're probably never going to know about them. They're just movie attendant number one or grocery store girl. Their faces surface briefly in our lives and then fade back into the mists of time. But I don't want these stories to go to waste. They're still great tales that deserve to be told. This week, I present to you three such stories chosen from my catalog. By themselves, they're not a whole meal, but when combined can satisfy your cravings quite nicely. So please, sit back, relax, and prepare to sample my first volume of Table Scraps. Seventeen-year-old Lily Olson stood on the streetcar, thinking of the poem that she had written to express how she felt. She was a good poet, and even won an award for it. She must be good, because how many 17-year-olds could boast that they were an award-winning poet? For her, it was only natural for her to channel her despair and desperation through a pen and allow it to flow out onto paper. Lily was only vaguely aware of her surroundings as she stood, lost in her own thoughts. It was New Year's Day, 1926, and Chicago streetcars were definitely not what they had been. But for someone like Lily, with next to no money, they were readily available and, for a shiny nickel, she could ride nearly anywhere in the city. Streetcars had been a staple of Chicago transportation since the mid-1800s. The city had grown continuously since then, spreading further out and boasting an increasingly larger population with each passing decade. It became more and more important to find a way to move larger groups of people from place to place within the confines of the city. Streetcars filled the need. The first ones were drawn by horses, large draft animals that pulled the cars full of people down the streets and avenues through the power of their heavily muscled frames. These were later replaced by electric cars. None of that really mattered to Lily. She looked out at the people going about their everyday business on the busy Chicago streets. They didn't care. They didn't even know she existed. She was just another orphan girl blending into the anonymous crowd. After her parents had died in Minneapolis, there was nothing left for her in Minnesota, so she had decided to make a fresh start in Chicago. Lily took a job as a filing clerk. Like so many people, she probably never planned on making it a career. It was only going to be a temporary thing until she made her big splash in the literary world. Also, like so many others, her big break never came. She managed to get a few of her poems published in a local poetry magazine, but she certainly wasn't opening any doors or, more importantly, managing to keep food in her belly. When she had stepped on the streetcar that day, Lily had only about 13 cents to her name. Lily was tired of it all. She took out the vial of poison from her pocket and pulled out the stopper. If she was going to die alone and poor, it was better just to get it over with. Thinking of her poem again, Lily closed her eyes and slowly exhaled. Before she could lose her nerve, Lily lifted the vial to her lips, tipped her head back, and began to drink. It began to work almost instantly. She felt the liquid burn her mouth and throat as she swallowed. It hurt, but she knew it was temporary, and that very soon she'd never hurt again. Lily's vision began to blur as she felt her legs first weaken and then buckle completely under her own weight. By the time she hit the floor, it was like it was happening to someone else. Faintly, she noticed that several people had rushed to her side to help before everything went dark. Lily's fellow passengers tried their best to render what help they could. The conductor stopped the car and someone got the attention of a traffic cop working nearby. The policeman ran in and found the girl unconscious on the floor. The passengers told him what had happened. Thinking quickly, the officer took Lily to Iroquois Memorial Hospital, where she was treated for poisoning. Thankfully, doctors were able to revive her, and Lily made a steady recovery. Creston, Iowa, the county seat of Union County in southwest Iowa, could boast that upwards of 50 trains passed through it every single day. It was a major railroading center and, as such, deserved to have an equally grandiose station to reflect that. In 1899, a large two-story station was constructed right by the railroad yard. It was made of light yellow-colored brick, punctuated by large, arching windows. Railroad offices were housed on the second story, while the first floor was focused around a green-tiled waiting room where passengers could buy a ticket, grab something to eat at the lunch counter, or simply wait comfortably until their train arrived outside. Some passengers could be trouble, and rail yards everywhere invited unwanted and unpaying passengers who were more than happy to stow away in a boxcar. To combat this, railroad companies would hire private detectives to police the property. J.W. Stanbridge was one such detective at Creston, and perhaps the best known. On a cold January night in 1909, Stanbridge was approached by a local farmer named Charles Rowe. Earlier that day, the two men had a minor argument over something, but everything had been resolved, at least for Stanbridge. Rowe, however, was absolutely convinced that Stanbridge had pulled a gun on him, and that just would not stand. Now, much later, Rowe was at the station to confront Stanbridge about it. The detective vehemently denied the accusation, but Rowe insisted. The two began to argue, and Rowe accused the detective of being everything but a fine, upstanding citizen. Now it was Stanbridge's turn to take exception. Temper flaring, the detective lunged at Rowe, grabbing him by the throat, trying to squeeze the life out of the angry farmer. Rowe tried to break free, but couldn't. Thinking quickly, he took out his pocket knife, the only weapon available to him. putting the blade up to the thick overcoat and material that covered Stanbridge's neck, Roe began to cut. The knife was sharp and went through the coat and deep into the detective's neck. Letting Roe go, Stanbridge put his hands to his own throat, trying to stem the flow of blood. He was taken to a local hospital, where he recovered from his wounds. Doctors said that if it hadn't have been for his coat, then the wound probably would have been fatal. Roe was taken into custody and indicted for attempted murder. In 1927, just as they are today, trains were an essential method of transporting large amounts of goods all over the United States. Long chains of boxcars stuffed with cargo were pulled by locomotive engines from place to place around the clock in a seemingly endless migration. That October, B.E. Matthews, a train conductor, and two workers named Rube Halverston and William Call were all hard at work loading cattle into a rail car in Phillips, South Dakota. Wherever you go, there's always someone willing to tell you how to do something. Sometimes the advice is welcome. Others, not so much. That day, it was definitely unwelcome. While they worked, Halverston took exception to the way Call was doing his work and began to complain about it. Matthews got involved shortly thereafter. The frustration began to rise inside Call, and soon, like a balloon swollen with too much water, his temper burst. Call's rage seemed to know no bounds as he produced a knife and attacked the others. He slashed the conductor in the mouth, bright red blood blossoming from the thin line made by the knife. Call swung again, cutting across Matthews' chest. The conductor, who had been caught by surprise with these first two blows, quickly regained his senses and began to run. Halverston wasn't so fortunate. Call swung the knife low and upward into Halverston's groin. Yanking it free, he viciously stabbed his victim twice more in the back. Halverston fell to the ground like a stone. Satisfied that he had taken care of one man, Call began to run after Matthews. He caught up with the conductor just as Matthews was climbing up and into the engine room at the front of the train. His upper body was inside, but his legs were still exposed. Call began to slash at them madly, cutting deep over and over again. By this time, other workers came over and stopped Call, restraining him. Matthews and Halverston, seriously injured, were taken to receive surgery at a hospital in nearby Pierre, while Call was arrested and taken to jail. While things were uncertain at first, both Matthews and Halverston survived, while Call awaited trial. History is, in essence, a collection of stories. What's more is that everyone has one. It's easy to think about these things as we watch our favorite documentaries or read about the historical events that we are most fascinated by. In the case of the larger events, like World War II, certain individuals stand out and are discussed, but, more frequently, whole, nameless throngs of people are glossed over. Each and every one of those faces had a name and a life, and at that moment in time were caught up in something bigger than they ever expected to be part of. What does it matter that someone got into a fight at a train station or rail yard, or tried to commit suicide in a streetcar? Think back on your own life. Remember that time when everybody got drunk at a party, then came back home and ordered pizza? It's a little fuzzy because while you were waiting, you all passed out. Someone else had to come in and wake you all up so that the poor delivery man could get paid. Or how about when you fell out of the tree in Grandma's backyard and broke your arm? In the scheme of things, neither of these stories would seem to matter much. However, they were a part of your life, even if you don't think about them very often. They are a single stitch in the warp and weft of the fabric that is your life. I hope that you don't see these table scraps that I've given you today as something less than you deserve. Rather, I hope that you see each story as a small, delicious bite of history meant to be appreciated and savored. You have been listening to John Brassard, Jr., the Kitchen Table Historian. I thank you all for coming out this week, and I sincerely hope that you'll make your way back next time to hear another strange tale that your grandma didn't want you to hear. This podcast was written and performed by yours truly, with the title music performed by Bo Moonlight and additional music provided by Audioblocks. Until next time, remember that no matter how calm things seem in the Midwest, there's always someone out there making things just a little weirder.